By Ryan's watch, it was 20 hours later when they paused in a spell of careful work on the slide to listen.
They're coming! Listen!
Fisher had been docile ever since the fight. Now he started tearing rocks aside. Half the town of Furnace Flat was waiting to see them stagger out of the slab bacon. Tom Lund was the first man to seize Grady, tears in his blue eyes.
The damn fool was lame for me. Hit me with a rock and I never come around for an hour.
Borax Kane was there to receive his geologist like a lost son. But Fisher's eyes, striking Ryan's for an instant, were ashamed. This man, Fisher's eyes said, has seen the core of me, the sawdust where there should be courage. And Grady knew that such shame could turn a man like Fisher into an enemy more dangerous than two-fisted Pat Hoagland. Margaret got through the crowd to him. Ryan held her, filled with an aching relief.
You will defy every omen under the sun. Do you believe me now?
Ryan hesitated, moved through gratitude to admit he had been wrong about everything. But a man's convictions were hard to shake.
I believe that college geologists should stay where they belong, in offices.
I bought two tickets to Tonopah. It was a deal I made with them. If they brought you out, I'd get you away from Cinnabar Flat for the summer.
You give the little people credit for knowing everything. Will they tell me how to keep the mines if I close them?
Perhaps if you'd go, they would. I'm using my ticket on the 1st of June. You can use yours when you feel like it. But you won't find Maggie Conway waiting long in Tonopah.
Maggie ran off to the railroad. There was a sharpness in the heart of Grady Ryan, but he was still standing there when she took a seat on the little car with its row of benches. He and Tom Lund drifted over to a flat car and sat on the edge of it while it filled. Lund seemed waiting for him to say something. At last, he couldn't stand to wait.
What will I tell the boys?
Tell them I'm alive? If you think they'd be interested?
No, I mean... Well, there's enough Cousin Jacks among them to keep the old superstitions alive. This looks bad to them. The owner of a mine nearly dying underground? What shall I tell them?
Tell them that we're going to work all summer. Extra pay. They'll bunk at Furnace Flat. I don't see why it should be so different from any other time of year.
Lund was silent for a while.
Kinda forgot what summer's like, ain't you?
I know better than most. But we're going to try it anyhow.
Though Grady Ryan did not know it, that was the night before summer. By 10 o'clock the following day, every miner and mucker in Cinnabar Flat knew it would be a day to remember. The thermometer just inside the big Tommyknocker number 1 registered 113. It was 117 by noon. A wind roused off the desert, rushing up the canyon with its kiln-like breath to carry gray clouds of dust into the mines. At 2, it was 120, and Grady had the good sense to dismiss all outside workers. The heat continued to roast Cinnabar Flat all week. Suddenly, it was apparent that it would not let up until winter. 5 months of skull-cracking heat ahead. Ryan went on summer schedule, put out water barrels, and raised wages. Kane posted a notice on his bulletin board.
Owing to unfair competition by the Ryan mines, we are forced to continue mining operations beyond our regular closing date.
And also, Grady speculated, owing to some unpaid notes and failing mines. The rich bellyache ledge was not living up to expectations. Ryan's number 1, after a slow start, was expanding and becoming purer. Despite the heat, he was almost optimistic by the night Lund came shamefacedly with a miner's delegation to the small sheet metal office building.
I tried to talk these stiffs out of it, but they will say their piece. They say they're quitting. They want the wages you've held back.
Ryan had been working with a desk which had come apart. Furniture had to be made in the valley without glue to endure the heat. He stood in the doorway, shirtless, sweating, a dark, blunt-chinned man with temper in his face.
What's the matter? Tired of waiting for that spree?
Tired of the heat.
What heat? It averages 60 in the mines. That's cool enough for anybody.
It don't average 60 after you come out at 7 a.m. Better than 100. And you can have my share of sleeping in a sheet metal shack, even at Furnace Flat.
Where do you think I sleep? You can bunk in one of the mines if you want.
Work, sleep, and eat underground? We ain't gophers, Ryan.
The watermen don't keep the barrels full either, Grady. They're always drying out and falling apart. And the chuck at Maggie's is getting worse. Meat spoils so fast, she's serving nothing but salt-cured bullhide.
All right. If you're bound to quit, you'll quit. But I can't pay your back wages. The agreement was that it kept them for a year. In a year, you'll get the money with interest.
That was the promise. Take it or leave it. But if you quit, you'll probably wander off to the gold mines or God knows where and lose out on it. Take a hitch in your belt and stay.
In the end, they decided to stay. Lund remained after they left.
There's something else. Did you specify seasoned lumber when you bought your timbering?
Something in Ryan slowed up and held its breath.
I picked it out myself.
Maybe you'd better let me pick it out next time. There's a lot of sag showing up. Some places the stalls and timbers are beginning to separate. The boys are grousing about snow in every damn drift we're working.
I'll look them over.
He said it casually enough, but it had the impact of a rock between the eyes. Snow. Catastrophe dust. The gentle sift of earth that preceded a cave-in. It meant faulty or inadequate timbering, and to replace timbering would mean the finish. He spent the better part of one night examining the stalls and timbers of the main drifts. Lund was right. Almost imperceptibly, the overheads were bowing. In other spots, the stalls had developed bad cracks. Ryan closeted himself with his books and did some figuring. New timbering at 6,000, labor at about half that. Lost time. He was scared. He wanted to tell everyone to keep his voice down, to walk softly, not to drop anything heavy. It was not immediately serious, but if the settling process continued, it would soon be serious enough to close the Tommyknocker mines for good. He had a heretical thought, one at variance with his nature, that no matter how much he made, it could never make up to him for the things he had lost. Maggie, Mysterious Smith, some cherished illusions. Happiness and the struggle for money were incompatible. When they touched, one was quick to tarnish. In this case, both had tarnished. On the 1st of June, Maggie Conway closed her cafe and moved over to Tonopah. For Ryan, the edge was off everything. He ate at a third-rate beanery and thought of Maggie's cherry pie. He rode home from work through amber dawns and dreamed of her hair. The stark beauty of the winter season had burned out in dust and heat. Sand and salt storms raging down in the furnace called Death Valley invaded the canyons, fouling machinery with grit. At night, the 90-degree heat was bearable, but by day, Cinnabar Flat was a ghost camp. Yet the ore coming out of Ryan's mines was clear as rock candy. Mill checks began to flutter back to him. Some of the pressure eased off. He'd lick them with this summer club of his. He could meet his first interest payment handily, get the Swiss to set the installment on the principal over till fall, and catch up then. He was thinking this the night Borax Kane came to call. Beyond him in the flare-lit darkness, Grady made out the barrel-shaped form of Mysterious Smith. Grady let them in. In the lamplight, Kane's face was a harsh pattern of impatience and anger bottled up until they soured. He wore a neckband shirt without the boiled collar, and his pants were dusty and creaseless. Smith, the patriarch of all prospectors, carried a large volume which Ryan discovered was a Bible. There was something withdrawn about his eyes. Ryan thought, the old son's gonna make a speech. Kane shot a glance at the heat-curled wall calendar.
June 16. Hell of a time to be in the valley. How much longer are we going to pussyfoot around this way?
I'm not pussyfooting. I'm mining borax with both hands.
And losing money every day.
A good mine will always pay itself off.
Kane let the mark slide off. Mysterious Smith stood by the door, gazing down the dim canyon.
Look here. We're a couple of strong mules, you and I, but we're pulling in the wrong directions. Now, Smith and I...
He glanced with some uncertainty at the Boraxer.
We've been talking about a merger.
Two wrongs do not make a right.
Kane looked disgusted.
Nor two bad minds are good. What's the matter, Mysterious? Bellyache mine go bad?
Smith shook his head slowly.
It's not that. It's the hatred and the strife that are wrong.
They didn't used to disagree with you.
Kane's temper suddenly ripped out at the seams. He strode to Grady's reeling desk and began to pound on it.
I've had enough of backing and filling over this. I've got you in a corner, Ryan, and you'll come out of it on my terms. We're gonna merge whether you like it or not, and the terms will be a lot more to your interest if you cooperate.
So you've got me in a corner now.
Borax Kane was taking a paper from an envelope. He unfolded it and let the miner have a brief glimpse of it before he replaced it. Grady felt a cold finger trace his spine.
That looked like my signature.
It should. That piece of paper was signed in Mojave. It was for a loan made by a man named Zehlendorf. It cost me a cut of the bellyache mines, but the point is...
I owe you instead of the Swiss now.
You may find me a less cooperative creditor. I see that you've got an installment of interest and principal due next week. I'll want it all in cash, unless we work out something else before then.
The ledger Ryan had flung struck Kane in the chest, and he went stumbling backward out the door. He rolled down the slope a short distance. Ryan heard him stumbling away in the darkness. He slumped into a chair, glaring at Smith. Smith shook his head.
You shouldn't have done that, boy.
I didn't have a gun. It was all I could grab.
You didn't used to be so buttish. You used to be slow going and smiling. Money's changed you.
Not money. Lack of money, Mysterious.
Smith deposited the 20-pound Bible on a table and opened it to a place marked with a bartender's suds knife.
I think I got this all figured out. It's all right here in the book. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Behold, all is vanity.
As he read, Ryan perceived that Smith had found the irrefutable apology for failure. The Lord wanted it that way.
That's okay. That's good stuff, Smith. But, damn it. Don't you wish we could have cut the mustard? You and I should never have busted up. We'd have stood this valley on its ear. We'd have had buckets of money by now. Remember that house you were going to build?
He closed the book slowly, stood looking down at it.
Now you've went and took that away from me. What's the matter with you, man? You're bitter to the core.
Just about. And if I don't find...
He sat up straight. Smith's face, too, acquired a curious look. He appeared to listen.
You hear something?
Ryan did. He had heard the sound several times in his life. Californians were bound to. A distant, shaking rumble. Then the shack began to rock. It was like being in a boxcar taking a turn, giving itself a shake and then straightening out. Dust shifted down to them, the hanging lamp swung, sheet metal siding clattered. It was over then. It might be the last, or it might be the beginning or end. It was an earthquake.
Glad I ain't a mind tonight, but we're pretty well tempered. Not like when I was a young feller. Your legs are stalls and shoulders are timbers. Better come up with me and have a shot of holy water, Grady.
Ryan got the words through the dust in his mouth.
No, I think I'll stick around a while yet. See you in town, Smith.
As the old man went out, Ryan sat and thought.
You missed a bet, old-timer. The Lord just spoke and you didn't even hear his voice.
It was practically supernatural. One minute he was saying the Bible was all right if you believed that sort of thing. The next, catastrophe. Rigidly, he kept his mind from plunging into conjecture. Falling rocks, broken timbers, crushed bodies of miners. These things swirled in the darkness just beyond the shores of consciousness. Smith's Bible lay on the desk. He turned it. The stuff the prospector had found so comforting was, he decided, downright level-headed. This preaching had come out of a wise head. He looked up, his eyes softening. Thinking of Maggie, he wished he'd turned an ear to what she had said. She'd had something to tell him, if only he'd been able to hear it. If he'd closed up for the summer, he wouldn't have had those boys in the mines tonight. He read on for a half hour. And by this device, Grady Ryan killed the half hour before they came for him. Tom Lund came alone, blundering up the path like a blind man. He stopped in the doorway, gripping both jambs, dirty, sweating. and scared.
Cave in number one. Haven't checked all the rest. Did you feel it?
Grady got his cap and lamp and went with him. Up and down the canyon, men scampered like ants. Inside the main Tommyknocker drift, they squeezed along between the walls and a line of ore cars carrying out tons of cleared rock. Shattered timbers thrust up from the flotsam. Grady worked through a gang of muckers. Jury timbering had been thrown up. Slabs of rock the size of an ore car had fallen. They were being laboriously dragged back to where they could be handled. Ryan took his place with the men. It was 3 a.m. when they cleared a snake hole.
Here, boys, here! They broke through!
Presently, a face showed in the aperture as a miner crawled through. 4 men came out. They told of 2 more trapped under the rocks. At 5, they recovered the bodies. A pearly daylight suffused the hot morning sky when they reached the grass. Ryan watched them carry the tarpaulin-draped bodies down to the railroad. He had an impulse to explain it wasn't his fault that an earthquake could catch anybody napping. Yet he knew the best defense he could make was to keep his mouth shut and try to salvage enough out of the wreckage of the Ryan mines to help out the widows. It was all cut and dried, the whole heartbreaking business closed. The fight, begun one night over a table in a saloon, was ended. There was nothing to do now but purge the soul with whiskey in that same saloon. Something holy about whiskey, too. Holy water, saloon variety. Beyond this point, cares dared not tread. He rode up to Furnace Flat with a carload of weary muckers. In the saloon, they left him alone, a hulking, haunt-eyed man frowning into a whiskey glass, as if words of wisdom might be written there. Certainly, he had found them nowhere else. Presently, Pat Hoagland, Fisher, and some of the Furnace Flat men came in. Hoagland wore a look of sanctimonious gravity, but inside he must have been ready to erupt with glee. Grady drank for an hour. He sat alone, taking his liquor with beer chasers. It was like pouring whiskey down a drain. It muddled without touching his grief. He kept seeing the broken forms of 2 miners who, but for him, would have been alive now. And yet he would have taken a miner's oath that those timbers would hold. Hoagland stopped by to lay a hand on his shoulder.
Sorry, old man.
He jumped as Grady started up, but Grady let himself sullenly back into the chair and merely watched as the Kane crowd departed. It was not long after this that red-headed Tom Lund barged into the saloon. Lund carried a short length of shattered 12x12. His cap was off. He was filthy with rock dust, but there was a kind of shine to him. He walked across the floor straight to where Ryan sat, swaying on his chair. Lund put the timber down on the table so heavily the legs creaked. He scrubbed the dirt away from the wood with a muddy handkerchief.
Look there. What do you call that?
Ryan looked at the timber with its splintered end and deep saw marks without comprehending.
I call that a busted timber.
I call it shenanigans.
The broken nail of his forefinger indicated 4 deep, blade-thick ruts across the wood. It was at the 4th that the tough grain of wood had broken.
I found a dozen of these doctor jobs in number one alone. Don't know how many other in the other mines.
Saws slip.
4-on-1 timber? 4 inches deep? The hell they do!
Ryan frowned. He discerned suddenly that it had been one of the cuts which caused the timber to break. Slowly he pushed his chair back. He stared at Lund.
Who set this thing up?
Lund's tawny eyes pinched.
That's what I've been trying to find out. I knew it was a gang of company busters I hired away from Hoagland. Oh, I thought they came along kind of easy. You won't find any of them on the payroll now. They quit, man at a time. Not even squawking about leaving half their wages. Why not? I reckon they were drawing pay up the line. I've talked to some of the boys who swear those busters practically locked them out of the mine while they done the timbering.
The whiskey finally caught fire. It warmed, fountained up darkly inside Ryan, turned loose something that had been a long time bound. He started across the room, lurched against the table and tipped it over. He had to grope his way. Lund grabbed an arm and steered him to the bar.
Give Mr. Ryan some coffee. Grady, I'm gonna make a speech. Soak up about a gallon of coffee while I talk. You men, now listen up. We got some shenanigans going on here, and it just killed two of ours.
Ryan never knew what Lund said, but he was conscious of loud voices in the saloon.
Bring that stick along. We're gonna nail Kane and the Hoagland up for everybody in Furnace Flat to see.
Ryan turned and saw mysterious Smith near him. Smith came over and gripped his arm.
40 years in the valley and I never seen a thing like this before. Won't again, neither.
Tell you a better stunt. Retimbering is gonna wreck the Tommyknocker. Kane knew that when he sent his hunkies in to high-grade us. I'll work for beans until we get them all tore out and replaced. Anybody gonna help me?
Ryan himself cooled the idea.
That's great. But what are we going to use for timbers?
Excuse the boss, boys. He's drunk. Kane's got a whole timber camp down there. All the 12x12s we'll need, and if we run short, we'll take them out of his mind. Why don't we start now, before it gets too hot?
Ryan, beginning to sober, was carried out with them. Hell was a great place to be from. You could not evaluate the things you had until you'd spent a few weeks there. This was Grady's conviction as they rattled along on the flat car. The heat seemed wonderful, the gaunt walls of calico stone beautiful. But the finest thing of all was to have been the black dog of Cinnabar Flat and to be accepted again by the sort of men you understood and respected. At 6 o'clock, the heat already pouring down into the canyon, the mines were deserted. Fine, Ryan thought. No one to object when they took the timbers. But he'd be having a talk with Kane and Hoagland one day. A moment later, scanning the sheet metal building, which was the local Furnace Flat office, he saw that the mines were not entirely deserted. Someone stood at a window, watching the work train coast in. He waved the donkey man on when the train began to slow.
We'll pick up granny bars before we go on up.
Sure, granny bars will do the job?
I've got a couple of hollow crowbars with .45 caliber ammunition in the office.
While the workmen swarmed up the slope to the tool crib, he and Tom secured guns from the office and stared up the tracks to the bellyache. Mysterious Smith had, mysteriously, disappeared. There were just the two of them walking up the tracks to the main hoppers, climbing along the hurry chute toward the gleaming corrugated shed leaning on stilts against the flank of the mountain. Two men without much shelter. The heat rose up sulfurously from the canyon as if from a river of molten iron. It must be hell in the shack, Ryan thought. The men in there must have good reason to stay inside. They were within 100 feet. A rough mule trail led from the chutes to the office. When they'd gone a short distance along it, Hoagland stepped into the doorway with a rifle.
Leave the guns if you're coming in!
Ryan stopped, his eyes taking inventory of the closest boulders.
The guns are the reason we're coming in.
He took 2 strides more when Hoagland snapped the gun up. Grady dived for a rock. He heard Lund digging in behind him. Grady lined the Colt out across the rock. He sent a slug crashing into the wall. It opened a small perforation in the metal and perhaps in someone inside. He sprinted another 20 feet up the trail.
I'll kill you both quicker than I would a Chuck Walla if you try to break in here. But I'm willing to dicker.
So am I. Here's my second offer.
So help us God, Ryan. We mean business. If you're coming here with any notion that we were responsible for your cave-in, leave it behind. We can adjust this.
One way.
Let the damn fools have it!
That shot came from a mine at it above them. Ryan began to crawl.
Whoa!
A shot from Hoagland struck in front of him and forced him to flatten against the ground. He wriggled around into a shallow depression. Lund, too, sought shelter from both points. Hoagland or Kane had fired once more from the building. Lund gripped his forearm the way a man did with more than a scratch. In a moment, he picked up his Colt and fired wildly at the shack, but dropped the gun immediately and tried to stanch the blood gouting from his arm. Ryan turned back. He could lie here and be picked over like carrion, or he could make a run for it. He took shells from his pocket and reloaded the gun. He pulled his legs up under him and braced himself.
I figured a fire stick of Dan over that way directly, Ryan. I'd lay still if I were you.
Ryan froze. From the sound, he figured Smith must be below the shed, somewhere between it and the railroad. For an instant, Hoagland was exposed at a window. Up in the mine, Fisher began wildly pumping shots down the slope. But Smith appeared to be well hidden. A moment later, something tan and cylindrical arched from the rocks, struck the tin roof, and rolled off to lie close beside the shack.
It's a trick! Stay inside!
But the men inside would not gamble. They lurched into the brassy sunlight, Hoagland firing as he came. He ran up the slope toward the mine, Kane sprinting for a rock and flopping beside it. Grady took cool aim at his former boss's running figure. Mysterious Smith took Kane from the back. Ethics, when dealing with men whose ethics were those of a sand rattler, seemed foolish. Fisher, not a man to stick by a partner any more than a principal, came out of the mine with his hands up. The blast crushed in one wall of the shack as dust rose about the building. Smith, it seemed, had not been bluffing. Grady Ryan left Furnace Flat on the narrow gauge for Tonopah that night, after seeing Tom Lund taken care of in the company infirmary. He and Smith had a brief talk about the possibility of a merger. Smith seemed to show a new burst of religion.
We'll do it right this time, and I think we should call the outfit the Golden Rule Mine.
Credit where credit's due. You name yours whatever you want. I'll keep on calling mine the Tommy Knocker.
He thought Maggie would like that. There was a lot of foolishness, of course. But if you had to believe in superstitions, the little people were good ones to stick with. Retirement Day by Peter Dawson. Slim, the apron, poured out a double shot of rye whiskey and looked at old Joe Miles.
This is on the house, Joe. For old time's sake.
The half-dozen men at the bar heard Slim and tried not to look at Joe, making small talk among themselves and not doing very well at it. Old Joe turned to the men.
So long, boys. See you. Well, see you one of these days.
Slim could see the relief on their faces when the swing doors up front hid old Joe's stooped slat of a figure.
To hell with the railroad. To hell with all these newfangled ideas. There's probably the last time we'll ever lay eyes on that old Jasper. He's still a good man, and they're kicking him out.
He's 67.
He's as old as he thinks he is. And until they gave him the sack, he was younger than me or you. Listen here, brother.
Slim leaned across the bar and wagged a forefinger in the man's face, not caring that his customer was a comparative newcomer and didn't know Joe Miles as well as he did the rest.
I've seen that old fool work three nights running without sleep, freighting food in here from the railhead through a blizzard you'd be scared to stick your nose out into. I've seen him take a three-team stage over a washed-out hill trail you'd balk at walking a mule across. Don't tell me Joe's no good anymore. When his old heart stops pumping, when they throwed 6 feet of dirt on him, then he'll be ready to retire.
A stillness settled over the near-empty saloon. No one had a word to say. It was, in a way, the most fitting tribute paid Joe Miles that day. Joe turned in off the walk at the office of the Blue Star Stage Lines, a weathered frame shack at the front of a huge hump-roofed barn. The man behind the wicket looked up from under his green eyeshade as Joe came in.
It'd spoil things if you had good weather for your last run, eh?
The oldster shook the rain from his coat.
What are they doing with you, Lynn?
Oh, making me bookkeeper down at Sands. I go down Tuesday by train.
Reckon I ought to ride the blame thing myself just to see what it's like. Maybe I ought to ask the railroad for a job, seeing as how they done me right plumb out of this one.
The door opened and a tall, rangy man strode in, shaking the rain off his slicker. It was Ray Dineen, 30, and married. For 10 years, he had ridden shotgun alongside old Joe on the stage run out of this mining camp to Sands, the town on the plain, where the Blue Star had its division office, halfway along its main line. Ray was making this last trip down with old Joe today, riding shotgun on the bank's regular weekend payroll shipment. Rumor had it the money chest would contain an additional $14,000 in gold for the railroad crew working out of Sands. There wasn't going to be any fuss taking it through, since the rail officials weren't anxious to attract attention. Starting next week, the new spur would be finished, and they would be sending trains through here and down to Sands, and this short branch of the Blue Star Lines would be a thing of the past. Ray Dineen looked up with a serious expression.
Hi, Joe.
He had something to say and didn't know how to say it.
I did everything I could do, Joe. Saw that young pup Ted Baker, the new superintendent. What a boss. Huh, my age and he's hoarding around med old enough to be his father. It's no use, Joe. Baker claims you're too old. He brought up that business about our getting drunk down in Vegas last December, too. Said I was lucky to be staying on after what happened.
Maybe we did raise too much sand that night. But we got here on time, didn't we? Drunk or sober? And we didn't kill no horses or wreck no equipment. What did it lined up for you, Ray?
A little of his inward pride couldn't help but show in Ray Dineen's eyes.
They're giving me a try at the ribbons.
Old Joe's eyes lighted up. He smacked a fist into an open palm.
Driving? The main line? Ray, there's a big pay, a future. I give you 10 years for it to make you division superintendent.
But that's the job they should be giving you. Hell, you deserve it. I don't.
Don't go soft-hearted for me. I got plans for the future. Besides, I got a notion I ought to retire, live on my savings.
Oh, what savings? You borrowed 20 from me last payday.
Ray Dineen's square face took on a bulldog look. But then he saw the pointlessness of the argument.
Damn it. Well, let's get her rolling. They're waiting out there on the walk by the bank. They'll be sore if we don't hurry.
5 minutes later, slicker on, his Stetson pulled down hard on his ears, old Joe wheeled the Concord down off the barn ramp and led his two half-wild teams of Morgans down street under tight rein. No passengers were along this trip. Lately, the load had been mostly freight, as today. Ray Dineen sat beside Joe, a double-barreled greener cradled across his knees. As the Concord pulled in at the edge of the walk by the bank, where four guards waited with a brass-bound money chest, the rain was coming down in a relentless spray whipped by the wind. The street lay a sea of mud, fetlock deep to the horses. The town had a bedraggled, sodden look about it.
Sling her up here when we keep an eye on her.
He and Ray reached down, got a hold on one of the chest's leather handles, and heaved it to the boot beneath them. Then the town lay behind, and the stage was rolling along a winding trail through the high pines and scrubby cedars. Old Joe hadn't paid the town much attention purposely, for he hated goodbyes and knew he might never again see the place he'd called home for 34 years. He'd live down in Sands from now on, get a cheap room, and be handy for a job if any came along. The railroad was hiring men at pick and shovel work along the new right-of-way. Maybe they'd take him on.
I saw Rivers at the door. What did he want?
Asked me if I thought we could get across Graveyard Wash. As though I hadn't been driving this road long enough to know.
Ray frowned.
Well, I wondered about that myself. Soon the kids are ahead somewhere in the wagon. They want to get to Sands before dark.
They'll make it.
Joe expertly concealed the instant tightening of worry inside him. Sue Dineen and Ray's kids, Ellen and young Tommy, heading down out of the mountains in a storm like this. Sue with a wagon load of goods, furniture, bedding, all their worldly possessions. And she was a frail woman at that, barely able to manage a team. He was blaming Ray when he remembered that at 1 o'clock, 2 hours ago, the sun had been shining on a balmy summer afternoon. This had been one of those freak summer storms, with the clouds piling up behind the peaks for the last 2 days and spilling their rain when they rolled on over the mountains to hit the cold updrafts on this side. It'd be a good long rain if old Joe's weather eye was cocked right.
She'll be all right. She's got a good head on her shoulders.
Joe decided not to worry. Sue had good enough sense not to head across Graveyard Wash if there was any water running. It was different with an old hand like him. He'd cheated the graveyard more times than he could count on his gnarled fingers and crooked toes. He'd learned to gauge the water that foamed along the bed of that 100-yard-wide wash that ran a torrent each time it even sprinkled in the hills. He'd taken his stage across many a time with half a day's traffic of riders and wagons and rigs held up on the road on each side, all afraid to tackle the surging flood of water. Once he'd caught hell for it from the superintendent when the water boiled in over the floor below and soiled the dress of the woman passenger. 4 miles down canyon, old Joe hit the first washout in the trail, with a 50-foot drop to the canyon floor on one side and a sheer climbing wall on the other. The Concord swayed dangerously, but was righted with perfect precision as Joe flicked one on-wheeler's rump with his whip and made the animal lunge into the pole. The right wheel hit solid ground again and jarred the vehicle clear to the through braces. Ray Dineen suddenly doubled up with pain. He straightened a second later, but not before old Joe had shot him a glance to see his rugged face white and lined in agony. Old Joe tightened the ribbons and drove home the brake.
Bouncing too much, Ray?
Oh, gut ache. Must be something.
A gripping pain took him and he doubled over once more. His hand went to his side below his belt. Then he caught himself and straightened up, taking his hand away.
Go on. I'll be all right in a minute or two.
We'll stop at Ford's.
Joe knew the signs. He had seen men taken with appendicitis before. He was wondering how long it would take John Ford to hitch his team to his buckboard and get Ray back to town. One thing they could all be thankful for was young Doc Slade, the Sawbones who'd come in last year and started healing people instead of feeding them those sugar pills old Doc Wheelwright left in his office when he died. They drove in at Ford's, a 30-acre ranch in a clearing along the canyon, a quarter hour later. By that time, the pain had hit Ray once again and then eased off. Ray was stubborn and wanted to go on.
Oh, yeah, what'll Sue and the kids do without me?
I'll look after Sue.
He met John Ford halfway between the yard fence and the house, explaining what he wanted.
Sure, I'll take him in right away.
Joe turned and started back toward the Concord, but Ford reached out and took a hold on his arm.
But there's something you ought to know before you go on, Joe. Chet Richter and Barney Ryan went past here about an hour ago, headed out to the road.
What do them two tramps got to do with this? I tell you, Ray's sick, John. You hurry and get that team harnessed.
I will, but listen, you bullheaded old fool. Think a minute. I said Chet Richter and Barney Ryan. You're carrying the railroad's gold, ain't you?
And I'll be carrying you out to that wagon shed unless you get a sudden move on.
Chet and Barney were fired last Tuesday for trying to lead the crew out on strike. They've been trying to work off their grudge against Paul Duvall all week. Don't that mean nothing to you?
It did. Old Joe finally got it. He faced John Ford with an angry light blazing in his watery blue eyes. He was worried and tired, his patience worn thin.
John, you ain't never got over shooting that rustler 20 years ago. These ain't the old days. If Chet and Barney laid so much as a finger on that money chest, they'd have every railroad detective this side of Kansas City out after them. Now get that rig ready and get Ray to town to Doc Slade. And if Ray don't get there in time, you're answering to me. Plenty.
Joe Miles settled to the long grind, and the rain turned into a downpour lashed by a cold wind, whipping up a spray off the rocks and trees that made it hard to see the road ahead. It was as miserable a drive as Joe could remember. He was cold to the bone, and in his sodden discomfort, without Ray's company, he was an old man, lonely, without hope, finished. He had a few regrets, not many. Of course, he should have saved his money through the years, put enough aside so he could spend these last empty years in some degree of comfort, resting. Probably he should have married Martha Drew 40 years ago, instead of being afraid to ask her and letting her wait so long she finally left with Spence Amston.
Good times and blown money made up for most of what I ain't got now. When a man can't any longer work, he ought to crawl into a hole and pull it in after him.
He thought of John Ford and of Chet Richter and Barney Ryan. He reached down and took the old greener from the hangers under the seat and broke open the weapon, seeing that the buckshot loads were fresh.
Well, that's one thing you never was, Joe Miles. Spooky.
Joe hung the shotgun under the seat again. He hadn't thought much about the payroll, but now that he remembered it, he was thinking of the old days when the town up above boomed, when every gold stage carried gun guards inside and out, and even then sometimes didn't get through with their precious freight.
That was 40 years ago.
That was when the scum of humanity flocked into these hills with gold fever, when he'd worn a six-gun the same as he'd worn his boots, and used it often. The formality of sending a guard along with each payroll shipment was merely a habit of Len Rivers's, who was of the old school, Joe's school, that had lived the hard way. In case of real trouble, a driver was expected to hand over what was in the boot and let the insurance detectives take care of running down the thieves. Chet Richter and Barney Ryan. Two undersized, lazy tramps who couldn't give a real man a workout either with guns or fists.
Men don't know how to use guns anymore. Not the way they did 40 years ago.
This country was settled, civilized. The stages giving way to the railroads. Joe Miles and his generation were giving way to men like Ray Dineen and Ted Baker, the new Blue Star superintendent. Men who would bring in new and better equipment, run it faster and longer, and make more money. Advancing ahead of the railroads, and maybe in the end, going over to the railroads themselves. In this sober moment, old Joe saw that his going was symbolic of a dying age. And in his loneliness, he was a little proud of his past, glad he wasn't beginning in this new era of change. Old Joe shook his head at the first sight of the wide wash. Muddy water boiled bank to bank across its 100-yard width. Already there was better than a foot and a half of water, with 3-foot waves churning up over the bars and the sand riffles. There was some driftwood, small seedling trees and bushes that had probably fallen in with caved cutbanks. Soon there would be larger trees. In fact, there was one down already, barely in sight upstream, a half-foot thick cottonwood, branches sheared off along its straight trunk, its huge bowl of spreading roots turning slowly in cartwheel fashion as it rolled lazily with the force of the current. He drove as far as the downgrade cutting in the high bank, a pleasing excitement running along his nerves, making him forget how he'd felt back a ways. This was what his life had been, a series of small adventures testing his ingenuity and toughness. Like this, getting two teams and a heavy stage across a roaring torrent. Few men could do it without letting an animal go down or bogging in quicksand. He could. He was still tough enough to do it right. He pulled the teams, letting his eye run over harness, the lashings on the boot. He tested the brake, spotted the line of the road opposite, and lifted the reins to send his Morgans into the downgrade.
Ray! Ray!
It was muted by the roar of the water, yet there was an emergency to the voice that brought him to his feet, looking downstream.
Ray!
A paralysis of stark, sudden fear gripped Joe. It was Sue Dineen's voice. His bleak old eyes whipped over the angry waters. What he saw made him lift his whip. 20 rods below, within a quarter of that distance of a sage-studded narrow strip of land still above the water toward the far bank, he saw the wagon and the horse and Sue and the kids. The wagon was bottom side up, the wheels half out of the water. Sue clung to the hub of the near front wheel, only her head and shoulders showing, and the water foaming about her shoulders, pressing her in against the wheel. She was caught there, otherwise she'd be with the kids who were standing above her on the overturned bed of the wagon, only to their knees in water. One horse was down, drowned, his 4 stiff legs sticking out of the water. The weight of the carcass must have been dragging at the harness, for as Joe took that one fleeting look, he saw the remaining animal lunge and try to break loose.
Hurry!
Joe laid his whip to his teams. The Concord lurched ahead, tilted into the downgrade. Joe looked back at the sound of a distant explosion. 100 yards back along the trail, he saw 2 riders coming in fast toward him. The one he recognized as Chet Richter aimed a 6-gun. The Concord lurched badly, righted itself, and the Morgan shied down off the bank and into knee-deep water. Old Joe laid on his whip, forgetting that to trot a horse in fast water is unsafe. The off-wheeler stumbled, went to his knees, and was up again. Joe held the horses to a walk, his eye on the wagon downstream. It might have been his imagination, but he thought that Sue was already lower in the water than when he'd first seen her. He whipped the teams, and they were pulling clear of the sand when suddenly one of the Morgans went down. An instant later, the report of a shot cut into the steady roar of the rushing water. Joe looked back to see Chet Richter and Barney Ryan about to head their horses into the water after him. Barney had shot the horse. The Concord's front wheel sank into quicksand. Then, lazily almost, the stage went over on its side. Joe jumped, landed on the back of the animal alongside the downed bronc, and with his clasp knife, he cut the wounded, kicking horse from the tangle of harness. He slid off the back of the animal and stood on the long tongue of the coach. Then, the water boiling about his legs and threatening to drag him off his slender perch, he unhitched the lead team from all but their singletree. The last thing he did before leaving the overturned Concord was to edge back and cut the lashings from the front boot. He worked feverishly while he watched Barney Ryan and Chet Richter wade their ponies on through the water toward him, Richter brandishing his pistol and calling something unintelligible above the roar of the water. The chest slid out from the ropes, stuck on a metal brace. Old Joe kicked it viciously until it finally slid into the water. He shook his fist at Ryan and Richter, 20 yards away now and coming fast. Then he freed the one remaining wheel bronc with a few deft slashes of his knife and threw himself on the back of one of the leaders.
Yeah! Yeah! Get a move on! Yeah!
He drove them away from the stage, clear of the tongue, and cut obliquely out at a walk toward the overturned wagon. He was almost even with it, every muscle in him strained to use the ribbons as a whip, yet he knew it meant disaster and a quick death if the horse he rode lost his footing on the shifting sandy bottom. He looked back once to see Chet Richter sitting his pony alongside the stage, holding Ryan's horse. Ryan was aboard the Concord, kicking in a window, probably in search of the money chest.
Go ahead, you scalawags. Waste your time.
He and the horses worked in toward the wagon.
Steady, Sue. I'm coming.
Joe!
Tom, Ray's 10-year-old boy, held on to his sister, Ellen. His straight yellow hair, like his dad's, lay plastered down across his forehead. He was crying, trying to reach down to take his mother's hand. The water was up to Sue Deneen's neck, occasionally boiling up over her head. Joe drove the horses alongside.
Joe, I'm caught. My legs are under the wagon. Take the children, Joe, please. Get them away before it's too late.
Joe slid off the back of the horse, holding the reins tight.
Hold on a minute longer.
He waded over and took Ellen under one arm, Tom under the other.
No, no.
Tom fought.
Don't leave, Mother.
We'll get her out. Now you act like a man, Tom.
He carried the children back to the horses and lifted them onto the back of the nearest.
Hold on. Tie it to the belly band.
Joe clamped their hands to the leather. Then he left them for the wagon again. He was working with an intent coolness now, not wasting a move.
Easy now.
He caught up the one rein of the frantic bay horse still hitched to the wagon. Somehow he backed the animal and then headed him downstream. He gathered the one rein and all at once lashed out fiercely.
Yeah! Yeah!
The horse, frightened into violent action, lunged against the harness. Joe whipped the animal unmercifully. The wagon slid, turned on its side, and then rolled on downstream as though its weight was no more than a packing box's. Sue tried to stand, couldn't, and went under. Joe was swept off his knees as he lunged to stop her from being dragged on with the current. He went under, then miraculously caught hold of her skirt and held it. He struggled to his feet, picked the unconscious girl up, and carried her to the horses. Somehow Joe managed to throw her over the back of the horse alongside her children. He slapped her face hard. Her eyes opened.
Plenty of time now, Sue. Grab a hold. I'll climb on with the kids.
She heard him, pulled himself onto the Morgan's back and took a hold on the heavy collar, a wave of thankfulness flooding her eyes as she saw her children beside her. Joe worked on around her horse and in alongside the other. All at once, a submerged tree surfaced. It rose from the current in a blinding sheet of spray. The Morgan shied. Old Joe, a weak hold on the harness strap, was dragged off his feet. He fell face down into the muddy, roiling water, his last glance toward the Morgans, showing them lunging into a run. Then he was under, rolling over and over along the gravelly bottom. His lungs fought for air, but he held his breath. Then he managed to strike out with hands and knees and slow the force of his rolling weight. The next time he turned over, he was facing squarely downstream with the current at his back. He struggled to his feet, his head above water and his lungs dragging in pure cold air. He looked downstream. The rolling bowl of the tree was now nothing but a shadow and the blur of rain fast disappearing. The horses were out of sight.
Sue! Sue, answer me! Tommy! Ellen!
His strength left his legs and he knew he was going down again. And this time he didn't care. He was too tired to care. He looked dully downstream once more. Coming toward him, dragging the broken front axle and one wheel of the wagon, he saw the remaining horse of Ray Deneen's team of bays. The horse plunged wildly, crazed with fear, straight up the stream. Joe struggled 5 steps and caught the one trailing rein as the horse lunged by. He held on, dragged hand over hand up the rein until he was alongside the animal. Then, in a last desperate effort, holding to the harness collar, he pulled the horse's head in toward the far bank, his legs dragging along the wash's rocky bottom. The bay stepped on him, tried to kick him, but he was lucky enough to keep his body out of line with the slashing hoofs. Five minutes later, the bay stood head down on the stream bank. Old Joe lay on his back in the sand, arms aching. When he could move, he started walking downstream, looking for some sign of Sue and the children. All he could remember was the plunging horses. The children couldn't have held on. He walked back and forth until dark, and all he found was the blue sweater Ellen wore, caught in the branch of a dead willow 2 miles below the road. He gave up then, knowing the answer. He walked back as far as the road and sat on the bank, looking out at the rushing waters through the darkness. There was 4 feet of water running now, nothing showing of the Concord but the one rear wheel idly turning in the current. The rain had stopped. Later, the sky cleared and the stars came out. He walked a half mile looking for Ray Dineen's bay horse and finally caught him. He found signs along the road that told him Chet Richter and Barney Ryan had ridden back into the hills. He gave them little thought, thinking mostly of Sue and those 2 kids of Ray's. At midnight, when he judged he could get the horse across the wash in the receding water, he began to think seriously of what to do. The first thing was to get to Ray, to break the news as gently as he could. He'd tell him how Sue fought to save the youngsters, and then how he'd fought to save them all. He waited here because the nearest ranch in toward the hills was 8 miles away, and he was afraid the tired bay couldn't carry him that far. But if he could get the gelding across the wash, there was a homesteader, Kaler, who had a place within a mile. He finally climbed onto the bay and headed him into the water, deeper than any he'd ever put a horse into, but he made it. Kaler's place, a mile down the trail, was deserted. The corral was empty. The wagon Joe had often seen in the barn lot on his way past was gone. So was the homesteader's team. But there was a saddle in the barn, and Joe took the hull and threw it on the bay. He was worried about the tired horse being able to carry him the 4 miles into Sands. The bay horse walked most of the 4 miles, and during that long hour and a half, the ghosts of Sue and Ellen and Tommy Dineen rode with Joe. When he saw the winking lights along the town street, he felt his first reluctance to face what lay ahead. He'd have to make a report to the sheriff. There would be questions, maybe accusations. He'd have to get the superintendent, young Ted Baker, out of bed and report the loss of 4 horses and all of his equipment. Of course, they'd find the money chest. The damned money grubbers would dredge the bed of the wash for 10 miles for their payroll. But that wouldn't bring back Sue and Ellen and Tommy Dineen. He was a quarter way along the street when he noticed the scattered crowd along the walk far ahead in front of the lights of the Blue Star stage station. It was late for such a crowd, but then a fight or a noisy drunk or maybe a man hurt could attract these countless loafers who never seem to sleep. Old Joe read a personal insult into the distant locomotive whistle. But for the locomotives and the twin ribbons of steel cutting across the plain, he'd still have his job. Have it until he died, and Sue and the kids wouldn't have been on their way down today. He reached the first stores along the street and continued riding down toward the group in front of the Blue Star.
Look, it's Joe Miles. Either him or his ghost.
Men stepped down off the walk, looked his way.
It ain't no ghost!
Half a dozen men ran up the street toward Joe. The swing doors of a saloon across the street burst outward, and a line of men filed out. More came from a saloon further along and joined the quickly gathering crowd in the street.
Get him and bring him over here!
Old Joe didn't know what was happening. He tried to turn the bay, but he wasn't fast enough. Hands reached up and pulled him out of the saddle. He was hoisted to two pairs of shoulders, even though he struck out feebly to shake loose the holds on his legs. Men crowded those who were carrying him. A few hats went into the air, and the shouts grew frenzied. They carried Joe across to the Blue Star stage station. All he knew was that these men were cheering, that they weren't mad. Abruptly, he was lowered and pushed up onto the walk to face young Ted Baker, the new Blue Star superintendent, who stood in the office doorway. Baker held up a hand to command silence. He was smiling. Old Joe shook loose a man who was holding him and waited, an ugly twist to his wrinkled face.
Well, Joe, we hardly know what to say.
You can start by telling me what the hell all this ruckus is about. I don't feel like joking. Something's happened. If you plan this as a send-off, you young squirt, you can lay off and listen to some bad news. This afternoon, I hit Graveyard to find a woman and two kids drowning. Ray Deneen's kids. Trying to get him out, I lost your outfit, horses and all. And I lost Sue and the kids, too. Now the whole pack of you clear out and
Joe, Joe! Sue and the children are across at the hotel in bed. Alive! Safe! Larry Kaler brought them in his wagon. They thought you drowned. We all thought you drowned. The sheriff has a posse rounded up, ready to start looking for your body at sunup.
Old Joe Miles stood there a good 5 seconds while the expectant hush held the crowd. Tears came to his eyes, streamed down his grizzled cheeks. Then, before any of them could reach out to catch him, his knees buckled and he fell full length onto the walk in a dead faint. Ted Baker was more worried than anyone else. For a half hour, he paced the hallway before the hotel room where they had carried old Joe. The doctor was in there with Joe, trying to bring him around. The medico was an ornery old devil who insisted on having the room cleared before he went to work. Finally, the door opened.
What about it? Will he live?
Live? There's nothing wrong with that old cuss. A little tuckered out, maybe, and bruised a bit. He'll be fit as a fiddle in the morning.
Baker took the chair. Joe started sitting up. Baker pushed him down again.
Take it easy, Joe.
Neither of them said anything for a couple of minutes. Then Baker began.
Sue Deneen told me everything that happened. She thought you drowned under that tree. She told me about Chet Richter and Barney Ryan. They were shooting at you, weren't they? They tried to take that payroll, didn't they?
I reckon. But your money's safe in the wash. I wasn't thinking much about Barney and Chet. It was the girl and them kids. I can't yet see how they got away safe.
Baker shook his head, his glance touched with admiration.
Because of you.
Baker had never before condescended to talk to his driver in this familiar offhand way. Joe hardly knew what to make of it.
There'll be a reward out for saving that payroll, Joe. Maybe $500 or $700. There's another thing that I'd like to talk over.
Shoot.
Old Joe waited, hoping young Baker wasn't going to go sentimental over his thanks or make more excuses about letting him go.
It's this, Joe. We've tried Ed Salzman for a year as superintendent on the Southern Division. He isn't working out well. I've done some thinking. We can run this efficiency and this new system into the ground. What we need is to keep the best of the old-timers. Men who can pull us out of a tight spot when we get in one, like the one today. This superintendent's job is mostly inside work, nothing like you're used to. But I was wondering if we could make you decide to stay on a few more years and take it.
What?
Old Joe tried to clear his throat so he could say yes. Baker understood. He got up out of his chair and went to the door.
I suppose you'll want Ray Deneen for one of your drivers, won't you?
Joe thought of something, sat up suddenly.
I forgot to tell you about Ray. This afternoon.
I know. A man just rode in with a note from Doc Slade to Ray's wife. Ray had his appendix out this afternoon. He's in fine shape.
Baker looked at his watch.
Get some sleep, and I'll see you in the morning, Joe. We'll whip this line into shape and make it pay.
Joe couldn't get to sleep for better than an hour. It didn't worry him much. He had always insisted that a man who slept too much was old or soft, and he wasn't either one. Great American Westerns is a graphic audio production. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Mort Shelby, Alexander Strain, Thomas Keegan, Tim Carlin, Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Nanette Savard, Tony Nam, Elizabeth Jernigan, Joe Brack, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Tim Getman, Christopher Graybill, Danny Gavigan, Drew Kopas, Michael John Casey, Alyssa Wilmoth, Richard Cutting, Gary Tells, Kimberly Gilbert, and Evan Casey. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Lawman's Debt was adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. All other stories adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Thomas Hogan, Allison Thomas, and Dwayne Beeman. With original music by Johann Detweiler and Thomas Hogan. Werewolf by Max Brand first appeared in Western Story Magazine. Copyright 1926 by Street & Smith Publications, Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1954 by Dorothy Faust. Acknowledgement is made to Condé Nast Publications, Incorporated, successors in interest to Street & Smith Corporation. The name Max Brand is a registered trademark with the United States Patent and Trademark Office and cannot be used for any purpose without express written permission. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, all rights reserved. The Great Slave by Zane Grey first appeared in Ladies' Home Journal. Copyright 1920 by Curtis Publishing Company. Copyright renewed 1948 by Lena Elise Gray. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, Zane Grey Incorporated, and HarperCollins Publishers, all rights reserved. Lawman's Debt by Alan LeMay first appeared under the byline Alan M. Emley in Dime Western. Copyright 1934 by Popular Publications Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1962 by Alan LeMay. Copyright 1995 by Golden West Literary Agency for restored material. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, all rights reserved. Redemption at Dry Creek by Cynthia Hasselhoff appeared for the first time in The Western Story, A Chronological Treasury, edited by John Tuska. Copyright 1995 by Cynthia Hasselhoff. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, all rights reserved. The Californian's Tale by Mark Twain first appeared in Liber Scriptorium, published in 1893, and was republished in Harper's Monthly, March 1902. It is in the public domain. Furnace Flat by Frank Bonham first appeared under the title Gun Dog of Furnace Flat in New Western. Copyright 1948 by Popular Publications Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1976 by Frank Bonham. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, all rights reserved. Retirement Day by Peter Dawson first appeared in Western Tales. Copyright 1942 by Popular Publications Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1970 by Dorothy S. Ewing. Recorded by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication is prohibited. If you enjoyed Great American Westerns Volume 4, be sure to look for Great American Westerns Volumes 1 through 3, as well as Elmer Kelton's The Wolf and the Buffalo. Available at Rogue Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio.
You just cannot stay out of trouble for any time at all, can you, boy?
Preacher, you sure have good timing.
I always have. Might have showed up a few minutes earlier, though, since you only left one of the varmints for me to kill.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, Number 3, The Violent Land.
Preacher, it is so good to see you again.
Well, it is mighty good to be here.
I'm glad the two of you were able to make it here today. I have a big supper planned.
Well, you two are flapping your gums. That varmint was about to shoot Preacher in the back.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Matt. I figured you'd take care of him.
What if I hadn't been paying attention?
Well, I knew you would be. Smoke and meat taught you well enough.
Where'd you say you were from?
Germany. Prussia, to be precise.
What's this about a wagon train?
Baron Friedrich von Hoffmann is our leader. He's taking a large group of settlers to the American state called Wyoming. The Baron has bought a ranch there and intends to establish a town as well.
Sounds like a fellow with big plans.
Oh, help! We gotta do something, Smoke. The Baron's had guards posted, but they won't be expecting something like that.
That's why you've got to get around them and warn everybody at the Raptor 9. Your horse is just as fast as mine or Preacher's, and you can organize a defense. There's no time to waste.
What about the two of you?
We're going to follow them. When they attack the ranch, we'll hit them where they least expect it. From behind.
Damn right we will. We'll have those varmints in a trap right where we want them.
It can't be.
I'm about to ride up there and see for myself. Want me to have the boys saddle a horse for you so you can come along with me?
Damn right I do. I want to see this with my own eyes.
It'll mean going onto that foreigner's range.
I don't give a damn about that. Pick out a dozen men to ride with us and tell them to be ready to fight.
Come on, Bat! We'll cover you!
Available now in graphic audio.
Who the hell are you?
I'm the law. And if you pull that pistol, I'm going to shove it up your ass and pull the trigger.
Graphic Audio presents Shootout at Broken Bow.
Put that thing back in your boot. It's time for you to call it a night. Get your money off the table and clear out of here. Maybe you'll have better luck tomorrow. Kind of an unfriendly way to greet customers.
Well, I'm sorry, mister, but the past few days around here has got a lot of folks kind of edgy when a stranger walks in.
You stay away from my wife!
I don't think so.
Oh, no!
Shut up!
He was here. Him and three of his boys.
How long ago?
He left here two nights ago.
Did he say where he was headed?
Nope, and I didn't ask him.
Did you see which way he headed when he left here?
Yeah, I watched him leave. He started out to the north following Boggy Creek.
So you found us. What are you aiming to do about it, seeing as how it's your gun against our four?
Well, that's just it, damn it. If you'd gone the hell back to Texas after you robbed that train at Durant Station, it wouldn't have caused me no problem. But now I ain't by myself. I expect in about 10 or 15 minutes it's gonna be somebody on that hill above us that ain't looking for no payoff.
My God, somebody's gonna pay for this. If I have to ride into Fort Smith and shoot that judge right down in his damn courtroom. It pleasures me to know that you're looking out for us.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.